Even though Saved by the Bell went off the air in 1993, it still has a firm grip on popular culture. The cast reunion of Zach and his high school friends on the Jimmy Fallon show recently went viral, and clips of the original show often pop up as internet memes, so much that sometimes it really does feel like it's Zach's world and we're just living in it.
Today, Saved by the Bell's executive producer, Peter Engel, joins us to take a look at his amazing life, which he writes about in his new memoir, I Was Saved by the Bell, stories of life, love, and dreams that do come true.
Listen as Peter Engel joins us to talk about that time when ABC almost gave John Lennon a talk show that would have been a showcase, as Lennon put it, for freaks, geeks, and people who want to start trouble.
Plus, what does Peter make of the fan theory that Saved by the Bell is just a dream that took place in Zach Morris's mind?
Will Elizabeth Berkley ever embrace her iconic role in the camp film classic Showgirls?
And Peter's biggest TV letdown, his pioneering sitcom, Sirota's Court, where a gay couple got married on TV in 1977.
I'm Fausto Fernos.
I'm Mark Fillion.
And this is Feast of Fun.
Today's Feast of Fun podcast is made available free to the public without any commercial interruption. Please consider making a donation at feastoffun.com/donate or become a paid subscriber at feastoffun.com/plus to support this podcast you love.
I'm here.
Hi, is this Peter Engel?
It is I. How are you?
I'm doing great. I'm so excited. I'm so excited. I'm so scared.
Mark, please.
This is Fausto Fernos.
And I'm Mark Fillion. We're both here together.
And I'm so excited, too.
Are you a little scared, at least?
A little. I've been doing a lot of these the last 14 days. In fact, I missed you guys in Chicago.
I know. I can't believe it. You know, I got the invitation to come and see you. It was just a day before, and I didn't have time for it. But you were here in Chicago signing your new book, I Was Saved by the Bell, at the pop-up restaurant based on the restaurant that's on the TV show Saved by the Bell.
It was a ball. It was like I'm sitting in that booth. You remember the booth where the kids used to sit?
Yeah.
I would sit in that booth with them after every rehearsal and give notes. And now I'm sitting there again. It was crazy. It was perfect. It was perfect. I mean, they did such a good job.
Now, I love that Saved by the Bell, the TV show you created, even though it went off the air in 1993, it still pops up all over the place. It has a firm grip on popular culture. And one of the most talked about episodes of the series was the anti-drug episode, Jesse's Song, where Jesse Spano, played by Elizabeth Berkley, took one too many caffeine pills to keep up with her schoolwork and her new singing group, Hot Sunday. And that's where the, I'm so excited, I'm so scared. Can you tell us a little bit about the making of the episode?
Right. I wrote that episode. I rewrote every episode, but I wrote that episode. And we had written it as if she was on amphetamine, speed. And then we're in a network meeting, and the arbitrators of good taste say, no way. Now, I just wanted to get out of the meeting and have a resolution to it. But Tom Tenowitz, who wrote it with me, said, how about caffeine pills? I didn't even know what the hell caffeine pills were. And they said, all right. And so we got the go-ahead to use caffeine pills. But we never changed a word, Mark. And I didn't write 17 Jesse with Mark Borgata. But they were so in the moment, and the audience was crying, and they were crying, that I went with it, you know. And it was on. We wrote it on speed, that she was on speed. Now, I had no idea how that would resonate with our audience. But when I went on my college tour, I guess in 07 or 08, that was the favorite episode of every girl I met, including my daughter.
From our vantage point, you know, we're huge fans of Elizabeth Berkley because of her appearance in the film Showgirls.
Right.
And the fact that she's just this actor who really puts her heart and soul into every project, and almost with a leap of faith, she loses herself in these intense, over-the-top roles.
I love her. She's a great lady. A terrific actress. I saw her, I guess, last year at Mario Lopez's surprise party, where I was a surprise speaker. Mm-hmm. And she's a lovely woman, and she's a terrific actress. And she puts herself out there. Yeah, you're right.
Do you think she was treated fairly by the media
no.
because of the film Showgirls?
No. I think she wasn't.
When she did Jimmy Fallon and so she sort of recreated that scene recently.
And Dancing with the Stars,
and
too,
Dancing
right?
with the Stars. It was really refreshing and wonderful to see that, see her sort of embracing her campy past.
Well, I mean, that was, you know, that's the most asked question I have had on this book tour is about Jesse's song. And it really resonated.
I think also, too, part of the reason maybe it resonated because, like, a lot of kids, they do take, like, no-dos and they do take caffeine pills because they think, hey, that's kind of safe, you know, because they're like, I have to be up all night studying for a test. Let me do this. And then, yeah, you know, young girls are all worried about their weight. And so they take, like, these diet pills that have a lot of caffeine into it, too. And so I think, you know, my friend's mother growing up was always just like, are you on those diet pills again? Because you're acting like a real bitch.
Is that what it was?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Peter, was there any kind of like hesitation? I mean, besides the fact that you wanted to write in the episode that she was on meth, but like, can you tell me a little bit of a sitting in a writer's table and sort of negotiating the creation of that episode?
We did a group storytelling. In words, all the writers would sit in the room and we would plot. And then one or more of us would go off and actually write the dialogue. And so if something happened, if a script came back that wasn't right, every one of the writers in the writer's room would have worked on it, so already knew what it was supposed to be. We decided we were going to do something a little edgier, and we put her on speed as peer pressure mounted between Stanford and SATs and then all her causes, right? She was the first, I mean, I created her as an empowered feminist who wasn't a pain in the ass. And she was with you. People have asked me, what would she be today? I said, she would have probably beaten Donald Trump if the character kept going. And so we decided to put her on speed. It wasn't really about the drugs as much as about the pressure that kids are and were under. To achieve and to do, and she between you know we made cheerleading a high art form with the three girls, and now they were Hot Sundays, a singing group, and our SATs hadn't been as good, and she was overwhelmed with everything, and that's what the story was about. In the room we said speed, because I had taken speed in my drug days to get through life at that point, in the 70s, and so I was, we were going to go for it. Of course, I was always too naive to think that they'd say no. Right? I just went for it. My whole career, I just went for it, and it was a great episode. I'm very proud of it.
In hindsight, looking back and considering that of all the episodes of Saved by the Bell, that's one certainly one that people remember and cherish and love the most. Was there any, would you have done it differently or sort of like pushed the show to do more edgier or more controversial topics?
We did another drug thing with no hope for dope, and we did drunk driving, and we did the oil spill where Elizabeth Berkley changed herself to the oil derrick in the hallway. Well, out of 100 episodes, we probably did 7 or 8 that were new to their time. As a matter of fact, in Promised Land with Matt Damon, he did the exact same scene with John Krasinski squirting oil over the how wonderful the fracking neighborhood is going to be with all the money. We did that scene in 1992 with Zach. And I'm watching this movie and going, I know that scene. I wrote that scene.
I imagine that when you're watching a lot of television and seeing the influence of your work, you know, certainly like a TV show like Glee, that definitely tackled, you know, bullying and homosexuality.
Yeah, right.
I'm sure. What are your thoughts on sort of seeing the continuation of your spirit and your sensibility?
Except people have asked me, would Bell wouldn't work today as a comedy? Like, for instance, if Glee wasn't a drama and it was a drama, it really was. And Bell would, there's so many, I won the first diversity award when Bill Cosby was Bill Cosby, and he for the Academy, and he called me a hero for my diverse casting. I would think today that diversity is so wide, and we offend each other so easily that we couldn't do Bell today as a comedy. We'd have to do it as a drama.
And interesting.
I think they did that with Glee. Now, of course, Kevin Reilly was the chairman of Fox when they did Glee, and he was the young executive out of Cornell who was assigned to our show. We named Screech's robot after him, Kevin the Robot.
You didn't like him.
Interesting that he put it on the air and stood behind it, and had been the executive on the first 2 years of Bell.
Mm. So I'm curious to know, because you've had this amazing career, which we'll get to in a second. What motivated you at this point in your life to create sort of your tell-all book on your incredible career, especially in producing Saved by the Bell?
Well, but there were so many people on the journey. Mm-hmm. From me running out of NYU and going up to NBC, I have to be a page. I heard today, I saw on the internet about 3 weeks ago, that it's harder to become an NBC page than to get into Harvard. And
they say that about every job. Every job that I've been applying for in the past couple of years, they're all like, it's harder to get into Harvard. I'm like, it's not that hard to get into Harvard anyway.
I guess not.
It's expensive to get into Harvard.
Yeah, well, I ran up there. It was not me. I was a shy kid. I was not the big mouth I am today. And what happened was, they said, we only take applications by mail. And I said, well, then I'm the first one here for the interview. And that was not me. They got 14,000 applications. They took 7. Mm. And I talked my way in. Someone had dropped out of the training. And so, that's the way you get in.
Now, you worked on President John F. Kennedy's presidential campaign.
Right. I did. And I was by his side every time he was in New York. They didn't have Secret Service men then on Kennedy until after Bobby Kennedy got shot in 1968. So there's a bunch of us young guys. We were the guys. My job was to get him in and out and back and forth.
I love the story you told in the book of how you were recruiting all the Catholic girls from the colleges to come. And you had to, like, sweet talk.
We didn't have anybody. Yeah. I would call the Mother Superiors and say, himself is coming to town. and they would turn them out 200-300 at a time. We called them the Kennedy girls. They wore these skimmer straw hats. And we called them the Kennedy girls, and he knew each one of them by their name.
And, you know, the election, of course, you know, we all think of JFK as a very beloved president, but it was a hard election for
him. It was hard. We were huge underdogs. No one really knew him that well publicly. He was a senator from Massachusetts, and he had no huge visibility.
And he was a Catholic.
And a Catholic, well, the second to run, Smith ran in the 20s, I believe. Mm-hmm. He was a Catholic, and he was everything that was hard to elect.
Can you tell me a little bit how his assassination affected you?
Killed me. Broke my heart. Because if you read in the book, which you can get at Amazon right now, in the book, during my 2 weeks in the Army, each summer, I was in the reserve for 7 years, I had just come through a terrible crash where one guy had a brain injury. My best friend was dead, and 2 teenage girls were dead. And so I was in a neck brace, and I was like hiding. And then 6 weeks after that, Kennedy got assassinated, and it broke my heart. But I had my heart broken before and since, and just killed me. My world, I knew it. I knew it the minute I heard it, I said, they got him. They got him because he was changing things, and they got him.
You describe your experience in working in entertainment as having your heart broken time and time again.
Time and time again. But that's what makes us it's how you come off the floor, Mark. It's how you come back. As Americans, we've always messed up from George Washington on, but we come back. Most people don't come back. And I had my heart broken personally and professionally over and over. Shows that coulda, woulda, shoulda. And I don't think I could have enjoyed. My company was on the contract, NBC, when Brandon Todikoff asked me to come over there after a disastrous 2 years of drug days. When they asked me to come over there, I thought this. I did 11 series with NBC during that since my partnership, and 7 of them went 5 years or more. There's not even a plaque on the wall. That's Mo Green from The Godfather. There's not even a statue of his name. Nothing. There's nothing. Anyway.
Was it Fred Rogers, Mr. Rogers, said it's like the great heroes of the world never have plaques or statues, ones who influence us the most.
I think you're right. And I thought, so to have 7 series that go 5 years or more, I was doing 6 shows at the same time. But I could never have enjoyed the hit of Bell if I had not had my heart broken all those times before. Mm. Unless you had your heart broken. Because if your heart's not broken, you will never make a hit.
What's the show that really broke your heart? What's the one that you're like, God, I wish this had really made it?
Sirota's Court.
Mm. Which that lasted a season, right?
It lasted, I think, 19 or 22 episodes. And it just faded away. We did a gay marriage in 1977. I must have been out of my mind.
What?
Because I was not an important producer. I was not Chuck Lorre or Dick Wolf or some of those. I had no power. This is my first primetime series, second primetime series. And I'm doing a gay wedding in 1977. I mean,
can we watch that?
Can you guys explain what the show is for the audience who may not know?
Sirota's Court was there was a judge in the early 70s named John Sirica who put the Watergate people in jail, the top people in government. He was a Republican. So Harvey Miller and I, who'd done The Odd Couple with my dear friend Gary Marshall, we decided to do a show based on John Sirica, Matthew Sirota. And he was the top judge in the state. And he put the governor in jail, and the new governor put him in night court with the dregs of society. We took on every social issue. John Rich, the New York Times, said that Sirota's Court would have been psychologically disturbing if it wasn't so outrageously funny. Everyone thought we had a hit, but the network and the audience weren't ready for it. It was 1977. I had no power to fight with them at that. And I fought with them all the time. I had no power. It was different in the 90s when I kept the lights on at NBC Productions.
Fred Willard played a district attorney, and the series later on influenced the TV series Night Court.
Exactly. They stole it from us. Yeah. And Universal didn't want to do anything about it. I was at NBC then. I was at Universal. And so I knew I was going to fight with them. Fred Willard was his first television job. And he was Bud, the DA, the Republican DA. And then we had great characters in that show.
What was the episode about with the gay marriage? Were they getting a divorce or something? Or they were trying to get married?
No. These two gay men had a marriage license. And Sirota had to make a decision whether or not to marry them. And you would imagine all the pressures in 1977. And he did.
Wow.
And he did. And we went bye-bye 5 or 6. It wasn't because of that. It was because we were doing all those things.
So is there any way that anybody can actually watch these? Is it on YouTube or can people buy the series?
I don't know where they are. I don't know.
I mean, this is an important part of history here.
I know. It's somewhere, okay? Because a couple of interviewers have told me they've watched them, and I can't remember where they are. But you guys know everything, so you'll be all. It may be on YouTube.
I'll get my Nancy Drews on it. Peter, I'm dying to know about your failed talk show experiment, where first you were trying to get Orson Welles, and then you went to try to get John Lennon.
No, first it was okay. I was at a company called Metro Media. We were doing a lot of things for ABC. The Undersea World of Jacques Cousteau, the National Geographics. It had been the David Walper Company. And they were trying to do a Saturday Night talk show. It was way before Saturday Night Live on ABC. And Elton Rule, I was dealing with him all the time because I'm a level. I wasn't a producing. I was head of sales at that time for Metro Media, and I was in New York for a year. And I started with Bette Davis, and she said, and we had great, and I just moved to California with my first wife, and she insisted I come back to produce it. And I, no way, and she, Bette got a little upset with me, and that didn't go. Then I had Orson Welles. I had breakfast, lunch, and dinner with him. Orson Welles, America. He hadn't been in the country for years, right? Mm-hmm. And we had breakfast, lunch, and dinner at this rented house. And we had a great day. And at the end, he said, where are we going to shoot this? I said, well, L.A. and New York, of course. And he said, well, I have a little problem. You probably heard of the Internal Revenue Service. And I said, yeah. He said, I can't shoot in the United States. I said, well, where are we going to shoot Orson Welles America? He says, Barcelona. I said, I can't sell Orson Welles America from Barcelona? I'm good, but I'm not that good. I said, we're going to interview Pepe the Bullfighter. And after dinner, I apologized for my outburst, and Orson Welles said, what outburst? And he put his arm around me. He said, you'll have your hit. It won't be this. And then, so I went back to ABC. I'm an Elton Rule's office president. And I said, if you can have anyone in the world, who do you want? He says, John Lennon. I said, John Lennon? John Lennon of the Beatles? He said, you get me John Lennon, and you'll have 26 weeks firm on Saturday night. So how do you get to see John Lennon? I called all the people I knew, William Morris, and I called all the people in England, and some woman said she could set up a 15-minute meeting with John Lennon. So I'm down in the East Village in this grungy place. I don't want to wait back there. Maybe he was buying the building. And he says, before you start, let me get it straight. Some guy picked my name out of a hat and wants to do it. I said, yeah. And he said, well, let me tell you what I want. I want to bring all the freaks and the geeks and the revolutionaries and the arsonists and the atheists and all that on. I'm not going to sit with my legs folded. I said, we're practically on the air. So as I'm leaving, I said, we'll put our attorneys in touch with your people. I said, but that's what I want. And if ABC wants John Lennon, that's what they're going to get, John Lennon. And so as I'm leaving, he goes, Peter, I'm doing a little thing Friday night. Why don't you bring your girlfriend? So as my guest. So I'm in the second row at Madison Square Garden for the one-to-one concert. Roberta Flack was the opening act, then Stevie Wonder, and then John Lennon with his band, right? Mm-hmm. And it's wild. And all the revolutionaries are sitting next to me, the Chicago Seven. There's Abbie Hoffman, and there's Jerry Rubin, and there's Tom Hayden. We're all in the same row, right? And I'm working for the most conservative company in America. But they like the money better, right? As mm-hmm. all. So it's unbelievable. It's incredible. And it was, I mean, it was unbelievable. I mean, that night. And then every time I go to ABC, Elton Rule would say, there's my hero. There's my warrior. How's John? John's great. John's great. One day I get a call from John's person. It wasn't his lawyer, but his representative. And he says, John has a little problem. And at the show, Yoko kept doing a little commentate. And the minute Yoko would come on to read something or to make a statement, you could feel the chill. The audience just didn't like Yoko, just sort of breaking up the Beatles, in their opinion. And so I get a call, and I call Elton. I said, we better meet. And I come and said, how's my guy? Great. John's great. He has just one little minor change. And he said, what's that? I said, well, you see, there's this person you probably never heard of, but he's very, respects her a lot. Her name is Yoko Ono. He said, Yoko Ono? She broke up the Beatles. And I said, yeah, but maybe they'll forget. He says to me, what does he want her to do? I said, nothing much. Minor, co-host. Get out of my office. And hey, Yoko, no show. John, people are saying, no, Yoko, no show. And I'm going back and forth trying to make this work, and I never could. So no one saw John Lennon's Saturday Night in America.
Are you familiar with that video that comedian Bill Burr hilariously narrates about John Lennon grooving with Chuck Berry on a talk show. I think it was the Mike Douglas show.
I don't think I've ever seen that.
And so Yoko Ono is there, and she just grabs the microphone in the middle of the performance on the Mike Douglas show, and she just starts screeching. And Chuck Berry has this reaction in his face.
Yeah.
Just like, what have I gotten myself into?
Right.
Well, a lot of people are not familiar, but later on in that episode of the Mike Douglas show, they had a microbiotic cook making egg rolls, frying them up on the show. And it was a mess. An absolute mess. I'm so saddened. I mean, reading about all your projects, to me, that's the one I would really love to see, like, a regular talk show with John Lennon and Yoko.
We would have been thrown off the air again, just like Sarota's gone. But my heart wasn't broken with those because they never happened. You know what I mean? Sarota's court broke my heart.
Well, Mike Douglas actually did bring it to life for one fateful night.
Right. But it wouldn't have been with Chuck Berry and John Lennon. Mike Douglas did a lot of good things, you know.
Yeah. So Saved by the Bell is your you know, pride and joy, the biggest project you've ever done. And would you agree, right? I mean, it's the title of your book.
Yeah, it was. It's stories of life, love, and dreams that do come true. Mm. I didn't want to do Bell. I said, no, get someone else. I don't want to do the kids' show. And, of course, 2 years later, we're in 85 countries, which no comedy had ever done more than six. The New York Times said, and you said, what a great idea. No, I said, get someone else. I didn't want to do kids' shows. I needed a primetime hit. Mm. And I came, my wife said, how was your day? And I said, well, you want me to do a kids' show? That's great. I said, who cares about kids' shows? He said, how about your kids? Mm. I went back and I said, you'll have a show in 3 weeks. Now, people forget. People forget we premiered in prime time three nights in August, and then the fourth was Saturday morning. And I knew the cast was great. My writing and producing were good. They were great. They were magic. But our lead-in was chipmunks. Our lead out was Smurfs, and we were against a raisin, a rabbit, and a bear. And I didn't know if anyone would ever find us.
Mm.
But, I mean, all my dreams came true with that show. I live in Santa Monica. I'm looking at the ocean. About a quarter mile up the beach is where we shot the Malibu Sands episode. And I didn't live here then. I lived in Brentwood. And that was like a whole family going to the ocean for 6 weeks. And it was just a great, great amount of fun.
Because that's the thing that you did with that show, because not only did you kind of retool an old show to create this one, but then you took this show and you kind of like rebranded it. Like they went to Hawaii, they went to like the clubs, or, you know, they spent some time at the beach.
We didn't rebrand it. What happened was NBC wanted another time period. I said, let's go to this. So we had two time periods. It was Bell, then California Dreams, then the first half hour was school episodes, the original. Second half hour, the adventures, the beach club, six episodes, Palm Desert, two episodes, etc. The Hawaii one was a movie for television. We did two. And that was the most fun, going to Hawaii with the cast. Remember, the whole family had to come because they were minors.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think why in the early 90s did television get obsessed with the teenage sitcom genre? I mean, you had Beverly Hills 90210, you have Saved by the Bell, of course. You had competing with all these other shows was Beverly Hills Teens. And
that was a drama.
Yeah. Well, that was meant to be a comedy. Beverly Hills 90210 was a drama,
Yeah, but Jenny Garth was up for my show as well. We were the first. And it was, you see, they had only been measuring audiences 2 to 6, 7 to 14, and 18 to 49.
Ah.
They didn't measure anything else.
Mm-hmm.
And our research people, who predicted doom, and I told Brandon Brandon Tartikoff, the president, they've got a lot of experience with doom, but I didn't really feel it, right, that we were going to be successful. And the same guys who predicted doom, about 6 weeks after on the air, Brandon called me to his office And they were there with these spreadsheets. And we had found an unreported audience, 12 to 17, tweens and teens. I said, what's a tween? Just below teens. I said, that a word? They said, it is now. We made it up in the room. That never. And we had more teenage and tween-age girls on Saturday morning than The Cosby Show on Thursday night, the number one show in television. Mm. And it was remarkable, but no one had ever measured that. And once we knew we had the tweens and teens, we never deviated from who we were trying to meet.
It's fascinating because today every internet company, startup, web series all want to market to that age group, 12 to 19.
Well, yes, because they have disposable income and no debts as a rule. I mean, the parents give them money. Well, they have jobs like I did. Mm-hmm. I was in college. And the thing is that everyone wants it because it's a great audience. I mean, they buy stuff. And remember, I should have gotten royalties on the Zach cell phone. That was the first cell phone ever on a television episode in the history of television. Mm. At Beepers, Dr. Kildare, they didn't have phones. And I lost all. I should have been paid by every cell phone company.
Well, what do you, you should have. What do you think? Like, let's talk about it's Zach's world and we're just living in it. About the fan theories that everything that happened on Save with the Bell is just a dream that Zach is having. And that's why he breaks that fourth wall and talks to the camera.
That's untrue.
No. But you see, I'm sure you've seen the articles and the fan theories about it.
That's totally untrue. Okay.
Well, why did you choose to have Mark Paul Gosselaar's character have that unique relationship to the camera that the other characters didn't?
Because he was the anchor of the show. Everything was seen through Zach's perspective.
It's Zach's world.
It was Zach's world, and we were in it. But I had him talking to the camera, and he could stop time and timeouts because I thought that would make him. And also, it moved us along. Mark Paul would come out at the top of the stairway or at the Max, and the audience would go berserk, and I'd say, hold. And then he would go, this week is finals. If I get a B in history, my father's going to give me a ski trip to Colorado in spring break. In that two sentences which I wrote, I just went through four pages of dialogue.
Mm.
And he could set the story up. He didn't have to crawl. And we're in. The minute Zach talked to the camera, we were in. And it was a great way of doing laying pipe in two sentences.
I read in your book that Mark Paul Gosselaar had a little bit of a trouble with the beat, the speech pattern that required to break the fourth wall.
Not really. He just came to me and wanted to go over it with me.
Well, you said you had to Jewish it up.
I said you have to do Jewish rhythms. Mm. If you find a guy who looks like Mark Paul Gosselaar and he can do Jewish rhythms, you got to stop. Okay, it was rhythms, not sayings.
Mm.
The rhythm of the Mel Brooks and the Lenny Bruces and all the great Gary Marshall,
Neil Simon.
Gary Marshall wasn't Jewish, but he had the rhythms. Okay. And so he came, and he read the line, and I read the line. And I thought it'd be the end of it. And he kept coming. And I kept reading the line. He didn't need to do it after the first week, but I guess he just wanted to. He didn't have trouble. He just wanted my help.
Mm.
And it was brilliant.
I'm surprised that more sitcoms don't utilize that breaking of the fourth wall.
How dare they? I'll sue them. They don't. What's his name?
Because it's so entertaining, and it's so. I think The Office sort of of false mockumentary style.
They had everybody talking to the camera, right?
Mm.
Yeah, I mean, it's George Burns was one of the first to do it.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, with George and Gracie.
Right. Say goodnight.
Well, it was kind of like it was a style that vaudevillians used. When they were doing a stage and the comedy skit wasn't as funny as they expected it, they would stop and turn to the audience and be like, isn't this a piece of shit? You know, and the audience, suddenly they're back in line with them, you know?
It was ingenious. Actually, it was Brandon Tartikoff's idea to have him talk to the camera.
Mm.
And so I wrote it.
What was it like working with him? Because he was, I mean, growing up, you always heard about him in the news and people.
Well, Brandon was only 32 and became president of the of NBC Entertainment. And he brought me there. And because I'd known him when he was head of comedy at NBC. And we used to have huge fights. I mean, I remember he came to the first taping and sat in the audience with his little girl. And he said to me, am I the only one who thinks they're in junior high? I said, absolutely. Because we had huge fights about it. I said, no one cares about junior high. I don't even remember people I was in college with, but I remember high school. High school, sexy. First blush, first crush, first kiss, first love, first heartbreak. And we resonated with the audience, and it's still with us.
Well, there's certainly like a latent sexuality there in Saved by the Bell. I mean, you had all these very attractive actors, with the exception of Dustin Diamond. And they were all behind the scenes, like the Brady Bunch, dating each other.
Well, that's what they did. And fortunately, none of them were dating each other while they were dating in the episodes.
So it was after the fact, not during the series?
No. It just turned out that way. Yeah, I never realized it. Until I thought about it, and then after Tiffany said everyone was dating everyone, which I knew, but only one night I talked to them for 3 hours. They were teenagers. They were cliques. There was only six of them. Of course, Dustin was only 11 when I signed him. I misread his headsheet, his birthday. But one night I have talked to them. Guys, if you are having conflict off camera, show up on camera. And we talked it through, and that was it. And that was it. I had another show, which I'll name nameless, where a couple were dating, and on the night they were supposed to fall in love, on camera, they broke up that morning. And that was not a good episode.
Oh, wow.
But it wasn't on Bell. It wasn't on Bell.
I heard that Dustin Diamond was extremely difficult on the set and certainly did things that would, in any office job, would get you fired.
That's not true.
So none of that actually happened because later on, I think like the whole cast will not speak to him.
Well, but that didn't happen when we were together.
Okay.
That happened when he said certain things about certain people, including me, in a book. And they wouldn't appear on the 25th anniversary People magazine cover with him. And they wouldn't appear with him on the Fallon thing, which had 35 million hits. But that's their choice. But that didn't happen while we were doing the show. But first of all, he was 11. They were 14 and 15. 11-year-olds don't hang out. They're not even in high school with 11, with 14 and 15. So he was never part of socially the group, right? Because there's a big difference between 11 and 14. But none of the things you're talking about did happen while we were doing the show.
Well, that sort of fated him to always be an outcast, both as a character and as an actor.
Well, he wasn't really an outcast. The things the kids liked most was that the most popular guy in school had the biggest geek as his best friend. So he wasn't an outcast in the show. Screech was a comedy genius. I mean, he was an absolute genius. And he would say, Peter, let me do it this way. All right, do it my way first in rehearsal. And he'd do it his way. It was usually better. But his problems were post-Bell.
Have you guys, does he reach out to you, or do you guys have any kind of contact with each other?
Yeah, I spoke to Mr. Belding last night. And Mario I talked to occasionally, and Elizabeth. And Mark Paul used to live near me. I used to bump into the local restaurants here at the beach.
What did you think when you first saw Showgirls?
You want the truth?
Yeah.
I told Newsweek that I was too young to see an NR-17 movie. But actually, it could have been Cusa. And then I told them what I felt terrible for her because she was so abused by the press. It was it was bad directing. Come on, you don't let a girl carry on like that unless you're a bad director. And she was young and she was naive and she was going to make her bones doing something totally different than Belle. And young people make mistakes. You know, I felt she made a mistake, but I felt badly for her, the way she became a joke, right?
Right.
Late night television. That was terrible.
Well, certainly, though, that, you know, in some way she's reprieved, because I believe that that actually that movie that she made is one of the highest grossing films on VHS, right? It was like $100 million.
Is that true?
It has made so much money because people, and it's a cult favorite. I mean, it's right up there with like Night of the Living Dead. Is like movies that people just absolutely adore.
And that's a lot because Elizabeth Berkley threw herself completely naked, mentally and physically, into this role.
Yeah, she did. I mean, she did.
I wish, if you have her ear, Peter, let her know that, you know, as a person who I think she, you know, I would love to see her collaborate or embrace that role and camp it up the way other actors have with their.
Well, she did that with past. I'm So Excited, you know, with the Speed episode on Belle. She did that in Dancing with the Stars. I don't know if she's ready to embrace this, but I'll bring it up to her. I love her.
Gina Gershon says she's ready to do the Broadway musical whenever, if she's willing to. Patrick Bristow, who played Marty Jacobson, he was Ellen DeGeneres' best friend in the TV series. He came on the podcast and he said that the director, Paul Verhoeven, was literally screaming at getting them to scream sarcastically their lines. So in that scene where he's like screaming at Elizabeth Berkley's stomach, crotch, whatever, thrust it. He was sarcastically delivering the take.
He destroyed her with that direction.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I didn't even know about what you're talking about. I just thought it was lousy direction. And I felt bad. I felt bad for her. But I think she's redeemed herself many times over.
Mm. Well, I love that made-for-TV movie that where she plays the sort of a woman who marries a husband and she kills him or something? Or?
I missed that one.
Any chance we'll get like a legitimate Saved by the Bell reunion in the future?
No. First of all, when Fallon did his reunion, my son works for YouTube. I called him, and they had my credit at the end. They froze it like it always did. And I thought they did that so well. And I called my son at YouTube, and I said, what do you think? How many hits? He said, 1 million to 1.5 million. I said, wow. We had 35 million hits over 2 days. And we still have them. That was just on YouTube. They did it so perfectly. I said to Mike, the guy, I can't remember his last name, who wrote it, I said, we couldn't have done that better. I couldn't have written that better than you did. Mm. Even to the numbers on the lockers. I said, well, those are real numbers? He said, yeah, we watched the episodes. I said, I never paid attention to the numbers. This was Kelly. This was Zach. This was Slater. They had it down to a T. And quite frankly, I felt that was the reunion. And why do it? We already did the fake Saved by the Bell. It was an accountant's dream called Saved by the Bell, the new class. Mm. 5 years. We did actually more of those than we did of the Bells.
Peter, it's an honor talking to you. We love your sensibility and your humor and your spirit of your book, I Was Saved by the Bell.
Stories of life, love, and dreams that do come true.
And one of the things that sort of really stays with me about your book was that everybody sort of has to find their own bell and impact the world in their own way.
Right.
Can you talk a little bit about that?
You got it. If you can make a living doing something you love, be it writing, painting, or designing, whatever it is, you're going to be a very lucky person. I love television. It was fun, even though the network was a pain in the ass. But not on the teen shows. On Last Comic Standing, it was like the Syrian Civil War. And someone asked me, what was it like with network interference on all those teen shows? You know, I did so many, I had the whole morning. I said, no, it was nothing. Linda Mancuso was head of it, came over to be president of my company. And they said, how about Last Comic Standing? I said, that was like being in the middle of the Syrian Civil War. They were always shooting themselves in the foot and me because of the mistakes. And you got to dream big because big dreams are hard to accomplish as little ones. And you can't give up. You got to lie. When I lie down on Brandon Tartikoff's floor, we would have been on. If I didn't do that, we would have been off and on in 7 weeks. You've got to have passion, and you can never, never, ever quit. And because someday, today will be a long time ago. Don't miss it. Mm. That's it.
And laugh it off when your heart gets broken or you make a mistake.
Hey, the difference with me is I knew what I didn't know. The guys I worked with last coming standing didn't know what they didn't know. But but broken heart, the success is so much sweeter when you've had your heart broken a million times.
Peter, thank you so much for talking to us.
My pleasure. It was fun. Feast of fun.
Thank you very much, and good luck with the book and on your future endeavors. Are you going to produce any more television, or are you done with TV?
I'm done.
You're done?
I'm done.
Well, if we're ever in California, Santa Monica, right?
You bet. Call me.
I'll look you up.
I hope so. You guys are fun.
Thank you. We'll be knocking on your door.
I'm sure you will.
I'm dying to hear more of the stories you can't talk about on the air.
Okay. All right. Bye.
Bye, Peter.
Bye. Peter Engel lives in Santa Monica, California. His book, I Was Saved by the Bell, Stories of Life, Love, and Dreams That Do Come True, his tell-all memoirs about his extraordinary career as a television producer and as a writer and as a media personality, is available through our website, feastoffun.com.
Yeah, some of the shows he's produced is California Dreams, Hang Time, City Guys, USA High, and Last Comic Standing, which has got, you know, we're here in Chicago, which is a comedy town. It's like people are dying to get on that television show.
If Elizabeth Berkley, if you are listening, do something with your showgirl's legacy.
Yes.
It's
don't give up on it. Fans love it, especially the gay boys. Oh, we dream.
We adore that movie. And, you know, I know it hurt tremendously. It probably cost you a lot of money and cost you a lot of opportunities, but it is part of your something that the universe gave to you for better or for worse. And it is something that millions of people all around the world adore, precisely because of the fact it's such a unique, reckless, strange, and ultimately wild ride through a film director and a writer's twisted vision of Las Vegas. And you're in the center of that film, and Peaches Christ, she sent you a couple of phone calls or check come on out. The podcast and talk about it.
Maybe Peaches can get Peter into the show. He could be this is what Vegas is all about.
And I have to say, Peter, what an extraordinary person. Mm-hmm. What a great outlook on life and such a passion for what he did. I hope that next year when I'm his age, that I will have the same kind of vitality to looking at what we do. And I hope that you guys do as well in your lives with the way he looks at the stuff that he's created and helped to make possible.
Yeah, it's an amazing body of work. And I want to remind people, too, that we can't do this podcast. We can't talk to fabulous people like Peter if it's not for your support. So please become a Plus member at feastoffun.com/plus, because it's really the best way to support the show. Or maybe you just like to make a one-time donation. You can do that at feastoffun.com/donate.
We're 100% listener-supported, premium, one-of-a-kind, in-depth programming that does Carol Channing says, Feast of Fun hits the very penetrating questions.
We also have fantastic t-shirts for sale at our store at feastoffun.com/store. Order now. They make wonderful holiday presents.
Thank you guys so much for listening. I'm Fausto Fernos.
I'm Mark Villian.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Mm-hmm.